area several years earlier, agreed to buy ComNet for $1.4 billion. Blackstone collected a $463 million profit, or 3.6 times its money. By mid-2000, Blackstone had cashed out of almost all its telecom investments. In the process, Gologli had brought home $1.5 billion in profit on five deals, making him the firm's newest star. The successes were sorely needed, too, because the exits came just as the dud deals led by Stockman and Lipson in 1997 and 1998 had begun to founder. The funeral chain prime succession Rose Hills, the wallpaper maker Imperial Home Decor, Premcor, the oil refiner, and steel rod maker Republic Technologies were all in deep trouble. Gologli's very success created a problem, however. With investors clamoring for ways to invest in communications companies, Gologli saw a chance to hang out his own shingle, and he told Schwartzman in 1999 that he planned to leave. It was the last thing Schwartzman wanted to hear at the time, for the firm could ill afford the loss of another senior dealmaker. Glenn Hutchins, who had been brought in as a partner in 1994, left to form a new firm, Silver Lake Partners, at the end of 1998. Stockman and Anthony Grillo, a partner who had moved over to buyouts from the restructuring team, departed in 1999. Without Gologli, the buyout group would be down to just two full-time partners, Lipson and Mossman. And Mossman never left his office. There was a growing concern over our reputation as a place with a lot of turnover, Peterson says. We hit a fork in the road, says Schwartzman. Schwartzman worked on Gologli first, persuading him to stay by offering to raise a new specialized fund that would invest only in telecom and media companies, and putting Gologli in charge of it. Gologli would get pretty much what he wanted, but under Blackstone's banner. For Schwartzman, it kept Gologli in the fold and allowed the firm to tap into the communications mania without having Blackstone's main fund put too much money at risk in one sector. The fundraising, which kicked off in early 2000, went quickly, and Blackstone Communications Partners, known as BCOM, hit its $2 billion target by June of that year. That still left the buyout ranks worryingly thin, however. Through the fall of 1999, the management committee and the private equity partners debated whether to hire from the outside and which associates to elevate. Ultimately, they decided to gamble on the homegrown talent and promote a big new class of partners. There was more risk bringing people in from the outside, where you don't know exactly how they'll fit culturally, Schwartzman says. In January 2000, the firm, which had only 12 partners at the time, expanded those ranks by five. David Blitzer, 30, Chin Chu, 33, Larry Guffey, 31, Brett Perlman, 33, and Neil Simpkins, 33. There were risks giving more responsibility to such a young crew. It would require more supervision, Schwartzman says. We'd have to work with them more. To keep an eye on them, Schwartzman recruited Robert Friedman, Blackstone's lead outside lawyer at Simpson Thatcher Bartlett, to join the buyout team to make sure nothing dropped through the cracks. It also wasn't clear how good the new partners would be at generating business. The whole corporate partnership model was to go out and call on and sit down with a CEO or a board as an equal, says Simon Lonergan, who was made partner in 2001. That had worked when it was Peterson, Schwartzman, and Stockman who were making the calls. How do you do that when you're in your early 30s? It was a risk, but Schwartzman and the other partners felt they had no choice. Chapter 14. An Expensive Trip to Germany. In the beginning, it had looked like a West Coast fad, the technology boom that shifted into high gear when Netscape, Yahoo, and the first generation of big internet companies went public. By the end of the 90s, though, the technology industries, the venture capitalists that supported them, and the religion for which they proselytized had become as disruptive to finance as their new inventions had been to established companies. Microsoft had displaced General Electric as the world's most valuable company, and 7 of the top 10 were in the computer or telecom industries. Coca-Cola, Toyota, and the oil and pharmaceutical companies, the old economy giants that had dominated the list for years, had been bumped off. With some venture funds chalking up returns of 100, 200, and even 300% a year, the lure of venture investing proved irresistible, and pension funds and endowments began redirecting more money to investment funds that specialized in startups and other technology companies. To these investors, venture capital, private equity, and real estate were all in the category of alternative assets, alternatives that offered higher returns than their mainstay investments in stocks and bonds. Venture firms, which had attracted a mere $10 billion in 1995, hauled in more than $59 billion in 1999, nearly the sum for buyout funds that year. More venture capital was raised in 1998 and 1999 than in the entire history of the industry through 1997. And in 2000, venture firms raked in $105 billion for the first time, surpassing buyout funds, which drew only $82 billion. Like a pile of poker chips pushed across the table from loser to winner, mounds of capital were being transferred away from traditional industries and investment firms to the technology and venture mavens, from New York to California. This rearranged the map of wealth. Nearly one quarter of the richest Americans were Californians, Forbes reported in 1998. The next year, John Doerr and Vinod Khosla of Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers, perhaps the best-known venture firm, were worth $1 billion each, as much as Henry Kravis and George Roberts, and considerably more than other buyout stars such as Teddy Forstman, Tom Lee, and Tom Hicks. Pete Peterson and Steve Schwarzman didn't even make the Forbes list. Blackstone couldn't help but feel the pressure to jump on the bandwagon. Brett Perlman, who became a partner in 2000, and other younger deal makers were lobbying to invest more in the tech sphere, and junior employees were clamoring to be paid partly in internet company stocks, the preferred currency of new economy workers. The firm was hearing it from some investors, too. When Schwartzman hit the road in 1999 to raise money for Blackstone's new mezzanine debt fund, which would lend money to mid-sized businesses, one potential investor who preferred venture funds just scoffed. "I make more money in a month than you make in a year in your mezz fund if things go well," he told Schwartzman. "We had enormous pressure here to be doing those deals," Schwartzman says. "We were viewed as not being modern." It was all irksome to Schwartzman, who thought the prices being paid for internet companies were ridiculous. But with firms like Doerr and Khosla's reaping stupendous returns, selling their tech startups and IPOs, it was hard not to be tugged in that direction. As you got to the 1999 period and into 2000, the amount of money people were making so quickly by putting capital in venture-type deals and flipping them in IPOs put enormous pressure on the buyout firms to participate in some level in that, says Schwartzman. Or else you could lose your people or lose your competitive returns. Competing with the VCs wasn't really an option, though. That took in-depth knowledge of tech industries, ranging from semiconductors and software to websites and biotechs, sectors where private equity firms had little, if any, expertise and few contacts. Moreover, entrepreneurs flocked to the venture firms that had backed the most successful investments. Why would they come to Blackstone, which had no track record and was on the wrong coast? Buyout firms that tried to intrude on the Californian finance turf were likely to get only companies that had been rejected by the top VCs. KKR formed a joint venture with the venture firm Accel, and Carlyle launched venture funds, but they never left a big mark. Schwartzman threw a bone to the troops by authorizing $7 million of the firm's own capital to be allocated for technology investments. The investment committee also gave the green light to a string of tech deals by the main buyout fund. Most were ultimately complete write-offs. Fortunately, they were all small. To Steve's credit, no matter how many times people said we're sort of missing the boat here on the Internet, Steve insisted over and over, "This is not what we do well," says Perlman. Telecommunications was a different matter, however. Many conventional phone companies and wireless and cable operators made money but needed additional capital. Many were large enough that private equity firms could put hundreds of millions of dollars to work at one company, which was nearly impossible with startups. So no sooner had Blackstone cashed out of the cable and cell companies it had bought in 1996 to 1998, than it waded back in, drawing on both its main 1998 fund and the new $2 billion media and telecoms fund that Mark Gologly oversaw. This time, though, many of the investments were a far cry from the stable rural cable and cell systems of the 90s. Some of the new round of deals looked more like speculative venture plays on a grand scale, big bets on startup businesses where Blackstone took only a minority stake and thus didn't control the business. And unlike a run-of-the-mill VC deal, these investments tended to be heavily leveraged. It plowed $227 million into Sirius Satellite Radio, a startup that was building a satellite broadcasting network, taking just a 9% stake. Another $176 million went into three overbuilder cable networks that hoped to compete with existing cable operators. Ambitious and dicey deals premised on projections that the upstarts could steal away enough customers to pay for the huge build-out costs. "It was definitely a dare-to-be-great sector," Perlman allows. Another $187 million went for a small stake in an Argentine cell phone operator, and Blackstone wrote a $23 million check to a Brazilian online service. The grandest plan of all, the second round of telecom deals, and the first major investment for Gologly's new fund, was in Germany. Richard Callahan, a cable executive from Denver, whom Gologly knew, had set up a private equity firm and invested in cable companies in France, Belgium, and Spain. In 1999, he approached Gologly about backing his firm in a bid to take over two regional cable systems being sold by Germany's state-owned phone company, Deutsche Telekom. Regulators mandated the divestitures so that new owners could offer phone and internet service over the cable lines, creating competition for Deutsche Telekom, which had long held a monopoly. Blackstone had been investing heavily in European real estate for several years, but it did not yet have an office in Europe and was far behind Carlyle, KKR, TPG, and other American private equity firms in penetrating the buyout market there. The Callahan deals, which together were worth $5.2 billion, would be the largest private equity investments to date in Europe, and a dramatic debut for Blackstone. Blackstone and Quebec's public pension fund, Caisse de dépôt et placement du Québec, were the lead investors, with the private equity arm of Bank of America and the Bass family of Texas also writing checks. It was an unusual deal for Blackstone because it would own just a 14% position amid a large consortium of investors, and Callahan's people would be taking the lead in managing the project. But Caisse de Dépôt and BFA had backed Callahan when he built a cable system from scratch in Spain, and they thought highly of David Colley, the British executive who had spearheaded that project and was slated to head up the German business. The physical networks and the customer base were already in place, so it looked like a simpler undertaking than the one in Spain. We looked at this and said, "Geez, it's a massive market. There's only one guy, Deutsche Telekom, offering local telephony. If we upgrade the infrastructure and get a small piece of the phone market, the payoff could be huge," says Simon Lonergan, the associate who relocated to his native Britain in 2000 and was Blackstone's liaison to Callahan's managers. The two networks, one in North Rhine-Westphalia along the central Rhine and the other in Baden-Württemberg, stretching east from the southern Rhine to Stuttgart, covered some of Germany's densest and most prosperous urban areas. The twin deals were signed in early 2000, and Callahan closed the purchase of the North Rhine network in July 2000 and that of the Baden-Württemberg system the following year. Together, the third buyout fund and the communications fund shelled out $320 million, the second largest sum Blackstone had ever invested. Deutsche Telekom's phone rates were so high that the investors figured they could easily skim off some of its customers. "The basic economics were incredibly attractive," Lonergan says. "The basic thesis made a lot of sense. The problem was the execution." Callahan and Colley planned $1 billion of capital spending the first year in a race to get the new equipment in place. But the management team that had performed so ably in Spain struggled in Germany. Colley and other senior staff didn't speak German and commuted from Britain and Spain, arriving Mondays and leaving Fridays. Soon, everything that could go wrong did. There were delays getting the equipment and software running, so the revenue from new services that was supposed to help cover the ongoing upgrade costs didn't materialize as planned. They also found they were hostage to Deutsche Telekom, which owned the conduits through which the cable wires ran. Callahan's engineers had problems getting access, and they discovered the hard way that the phone company's maps of cable paths didn't always correspond to reality. When they installed their new equipment, they sometimes unwittingly blacked out whole neighborhoods. Once, much of Cologne lost its cable signal during a key soccer match, and the company found itself pilloried on the front pages of the local papers. Nor had Callahan's people factored in the housing cooperatives that own many big German apartment complexes and control the last leg of the network into tens of thousands of homes. Deutsche Telekom and Callahan relied on the co-ops to collect the phone and cable bills from their tenants. But the co-ops proved lackadaisical about dunning tenants who were in arrears, so revenues fell even further behind budget. Through late 2001, Colley's team reported to Blackstone and the other investors that everything was more or less on track, when, in fact, the North Rhine-Westphalia system was burning through money at an alarming rate, and wasn't completing enough of the upgrade or selling enough new services to keep pace. Worse still, management didn't have proper accounting systems in place to monitor how much cash it had. In early 2002, when the investors began pressing Colley and his people about the cash flow situation, they couldn't get an answer. It was only by going to some of the regular meetings with them and digging into the numbers with them, all of a sudden there was this aha moment. "Something's not right here," says William Obenshain, who oversaw the investment for Bank of America. "Either we were being misled, or the management just didn't have a grip on it. These meetings were very unpleasant." When Callahan's crew finally did succeed in calculating its cash position, the company turned out to have more than 100 million euros less than it should have had, and was in imminent danger of violating the terms of its loans, which required it to have minimum cash flows and cash levels. Seemingly overnight, a massive investment had veered from on course to crisis. 2 years earlier, at the height of the telecom boom, the company probably could have borrowed more money or refinanced its debt so it could complete the upgrade. But in 2002, that was impossible. Gologli, Lonergan, Obenchain, and the other investors scrambled to get things under control. Spending was reined in at the Baden-Württemberg company, where the upgrade had only just begun to get underway. But it was too late. Short on cash, the Callahan entities breached the terms of their loans. It was clear the equity was going to be erased, and Blackstone was forced to write off its entire investment at the end of 2002. When Callahan arrived at Schwartzman's office to discuss what had happened, he got an earful from Schwartzman. "Where's my fucking money, you dumb shit?" were the first words out of Schwartzman's mouth, according to a person with ties to Callahan. I was really furious because he was personally working on a lot of other transactions rather than keeping his focus on this particular transaction, says Schwartzman, who calls it a chilly meeting. I told him I believed he had failed. The loss was most devastating for the new media and telecom fund, because the $159 million it had contributed from its kitty represented more than 70% of its invested capital to that point. 2 years after it was raised, the fund was in a deep hole, and with the entire telecom industry in a severe slump by 2003, it wasn't clear how it could dig its way out through new investments. Callahan was only the biggest failure. 2/3 of the investments Blackstone made in 2000 at the height of the market were wipeouts. The write-offs were an object lesson in the dangers of wagering on companies in a frothy market, a lesson that would echo again when the credit markets crashed in 2007 and the economy began spiraling downward. Most of the other mistakes were small, but not all. In addition to the Callahan setbacks, the Argentine cell operator CTI Holdings cost Blackstone $185 million, and two companies that aimed to build new cable systems from scratch, Utilicom Networks and Nology, were complete losses. So was the investment in Sirius, the satellite radio company. The pain we took on the investments of 2000 was a real turning point, says David Blitzer, who had joined Blackstone out of college not long after the disastrous collapse of the Edgecombe investment and become a partner in 2000, just as the firm again was about to stumble badly. Losing money again was really a jolt to the system. How could we let this happen? What did we do wrong? It was a time of real soul-searching, he says. Blackstone was hardly alone. The losses it suffered in 2001 and 2002 came as the technology and telecom bubbles were pricked, and air hissed out of the entire stock market. European stocks topped out in the winter of 1999 and 2000. In the United States, the IPO market cooled off in early 2000. The technology-heavy Nasdaq stock index crested in April 2000 at 5 times its 1995 level. The broader S&P 500 index, which had tripled in 5 years, inched up until that August. From there, it was all downhill. The skepticism that it poured cold water on the IPO market that spring spread to junk bonds. New issues were down by 3/4 in the spring of 2000 from their peak 2 years earlier. Across all the capital markets, worries grew that the economy might slow and that the miracle markets of the past 5 years might be coming to an end, just as they had at the end of the 1980s, after a long run-up. Investors no longer wanted to roll the dice on profitless startups, and they didn't want to lend to highly leveraged companies whose cash flows might evaporate if the economy slowed. The downturn was most catastrophic for tech companies and their investors, but buyout firms, particularly those that had forged deeply into telecoms, soon began to take their lumps. The dare-to-be-great telecom build-outs that Blackstone and others had funded began to totter and collapse, victims of both the buyout firm's over-optimistic projections and the slumping stock and debt markets, which made it impossible to raise new money if the projects hit a snag. As stinging as Blackstone's losses were, they paled by comparison to the debacles of some competitors. At Hicks, Muse, Tate, and First, the Texas firm that grew to be a major player in the later years of the 90s, well over $2 billion of its investors' money was incinerated in 11 disastrous deals over 3 years, mostly in telecoms. Ted Forstman, who had railed publicly against the risks KKR and others were taking with leverage in the 1980s, proved to be one of the most reckless gamblers of the 90s, plunking $2.5 billion, much of his funding, into just two companies, XO Communications and McLeod USA, which were building phone, cable, and internet networks to compete with the Bell phone companies. Forstman Little lost it all when both had to be restructured in 2002. Welsh Carson, J.P. Morgan Partners, DLJ Merchant Banking, Madison Dearborn, some of the best names in the business, watched as one telecom investment of theirs after another cratered. Many found it harder to raise their next funds and were knocked down a peg or two in the pecking order. Forstman's and Hicks's losses put their firms near death's door. Forstman Little made only two significant investments after 2000 and slowly sold off old holdings. Exacerbating its woes, the state of Connecticut, which had invested in Forstman's fund, sued in February 2002, claiming the firm had breached its agreements with investors by putting so much of its capital into just two risky investments. Ted Forstman found himself on the witness stand in 2004, where he was grilled publicly about the calamitous decisions. In a quirky outcome, the jury found that the firm had violated its investment contract, but awarded no damages. When Tom Hicks tried to raise a new fund in 2000 to match his $4.1 billion pool of 1998, his investors balked. Most weren't convinced the firm deserved a second chance, and in 2002 it had to settle for $1.6 billion. In 2004, Tom Hicks announced that he planned to retire. The firm's London team, which had a good track record, split off in 2005. The remaining U.S. organization renamed itself HM Capital Partners and regrouped, focusing on smaller deals. The carnage extended far beyond telecoms. In one of the biggest crack-ups, the $1.4 billion buyout in 1996 of the bowling equipment and bowling lane operator, AMF Bowling Worldwide, proved to be a $560 million gutter ball for Goldman Sachs Private Equity Group, which had led the deal. Blackstone, which tagged along for the ride with a minority investment, lost $73.5 million of its money. Meanwhile, KKR, Hicks, Muse, Tate, and First, and DLJ kissed goodbye to more than $1 billion in the Regal Cinemas chain. 62 major private equity-backed companies went bust in 2001, vaporizing $12 billion of equity by one tally. Another 46 failed in the first half of 2002, wiping out a further $7.6 billion. And there were many more, smaller deals that never came onto the public radar. By the end of 2000, virtually no LBOs were being done in the United States. Then came the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, and the stock and debt markets, which had been sputtering for a year, had the final wind knocked out of them. With the public afraid to fly, airlines and the rest of the travel industry saw business dry up, setting off a domino-like line of bankruptcies, from the airlines themselves to Samsonite, the luggage maker, which was part-owned by Apollo. Blackstone narrowly escaped losing one of its real estate jewels, the Savoy Group, which owned four of the poshest hotels in London. One day, no guests checked into Claridge's, perhaps the most exclusive hostelry in the city. The mood was grim. With the World Trade Center ruins smoldering for 5 months after the attacks, people wondered out loud if New York would survive as a world financial center. As time went by, the slowdown took a growing toll on leveraged companies. By 2002, the default rate on junk bonds had shot to 13%. By September 2002, the broad S&P 500 index of U.S. stocks had fallen by almost half from its peak 2 years earlier, and the NASDAQ was 75% off its high. Confidence was further sapped by corporate scandals. In December 2001, Enron Corporation, a pipeline operator and energy trading firm that had been a darling of Wall Street, imploded after it was revealed that the company had concealed billions of dollars of liabilities. WorldCom, a giant telecom that had grown through acquisitions to become AT&T's chief competitor in long-distance phone service, filed for bankruptcy in July 2002, after its books, too, turned out to be cooked. Adelphi Communications, a big cable operator, also went bust after disclosing that it had kept secret several $1 billion of loan guarantees to its controlling shareholders, the Riga family. When the U.S. government indicted the global accounting firm Arthur Andersen, which had audited both Enron and WorldCom for destroying Enron documents, that only reinforced the growing suspicion that corporate financial statements meant nothing. The downturn was a boon to Blackstone's restructuring and M&A groups, which won key roles in Enron's bankruptcy, one of the largest and most complex reorganizations ever. Arthur Newman's team was also tapped by Delta Airlines, whose bankruptcy was complicated by contentious labor relations, and by Global Crossing, one of the highest-flying international telecoms of the 1990s. But for the second time in a decade, Blackstone's LBO business was cast into limbo. It was virtually impossible to obtain financing, and sellers couldn't accept that values had fallen. Big buyouts continued to be done in Europe, where the credit markets were healthier, and LBO activity there surpassed that of the United States from 2001 to 2003. But because Blackstone had been slow to focus on Europe, the opportunities went to its American competitors and big British buyout firms such as Apax Partners, BC Partners, CVC Capital Partners, Cinven, and Permira, which had the networks of connections and strong records there. From the summer of 2000, Blackstone went nearly 2 years without closing a conventional buyout. After the Callahan projects in Germany in 2000, it was 4 years before Blackstone's communications fund invested in the equity of another company. Chapter 15. Ahead of the Curve. While the stock and debt markets were still sliding in late 2001 and 2002, it was nearly impossible to pull off a buyout. Companies were still struggling, and cash flows were tanking, so financing one was an ordeal. But Blackstone was sitting on billions it had raised in better times. Going into 2001, It still had more than $1 billion left from its $4 billion 1997 fund, as well as nearly all of the communication fund's $2 billion, and it was gearing up to raise a fourth generalist fund. Sooner or later, it would have to deploy this money. It could wait until the credit markets recovered, or it could find alternatives to the classic leveraged buyout. The strategy that unfolded revealed a truth about private equity that is seldom observed by those outside the financial world. It is defined more by opportunism than by the conventional LBO. Other things being equal, buyouts are the norm. But things were anything but equal in 2001 and 2002. In a rising market, leveraging equity with debt produces supercharged returns by amplifying any gain in the value of the equity. In troubled times, however, it can pay to invest instead at other levels of a corporation's capital structure or to make unleveraged equity investments. Relatively low-risk senior debt of a company may pay as much as 15%, not too far short of the 20%-plus returns buyout firms typically aim for. Riskier, more junior debt may pay even more and may be swapped for equity down the road. When stock and bond markets fall, that's another way of saying that the price of capital has risen. Investors demand higher returns because they perceive more risk, and companies have to offer more stock to raise the same amount of new equity capital and must pay higher interest rates to borrow. When the world at large is preoccupied with what can go wrong and afraid to stake money, those brave enough to invest can exact a very high price. Blackstone's deal-making in 2001 and 2002 reflected that fact of economic life. The events of September 11, 2001 provided a case in point. One of the collateral casualties of the terrorist attacks was the insurance industry, which found itself staring at billions of dollars of unexpected claims, not only from those hurt directly at the World Trade Center, but also from business interruption and other commercial policies covering companies far removed from New York and Washington. Overnight, capital reserves that had been built up over years as a cushion against losses were exhausted. Reinsurance companies, which protect other insurers against freak and catastrophic claims, were hit particularly hard because the attacks were so far outside any actuarial predictions, and the damage penetrated beyond the original insurer's coverage up into the reinsurers. Because insurance companies are required by law to maintain reserves to back the policies they write, the losses forced many insurers to curtail business, writing fewer new policies. That sent premiums skyward. Private equity firms pounced on the opportunity, pouring money into the sector. KKR, Hellman & Friedman, TPG, and Warburg Pincus, to name just a few. Rather than invest in existing companies that still had big claims to work off, however, they set up new reinsurers with clean balance sheets that now would face little competition from existing wounded companies. 2 months after the terrorist attacks, Blackstone plowed $201 million into Axis Capital, a new reinsurer it formed with four other private equity firms. The next June, it invested $268 million alongside the London buyout firm Candover Investments and others to form another new reinsurer, Aspen Insurance, around assets that a troubled London reinsurer, Wellington Ray, was forced to sell. These were 100% equity investments in startups without leverage. In a crippled industry, they had the potential to match the returns Blackstone expected on LBOs in good times because the new players would be abnormally profitable. At the time, it looked like probably a 3-year opportunity, says Schwartzman. After that, More capital would flow into the industry, boosting competition, driving down premiums, and causing returns to fall back to historical levels. We would not make an amazing return by the nature of the industry, but you could make 21 or 22 or 23% a year for a few years. Ultimately, Blackstone made a 30.2% annual return on Axis. Aspen might have matched that, but it suffered big losses from Hurricane Katrina in 2005, so Blackstone ultimately earned only a 15% return. In mid-2002, with the stock market still falling, Blackstone veered even further from its customary investment formulae, detouring into vulture debt investing, a treacherous new territory where it had ventured only a few times before, such as when it bought debt of the shopping mall owner DeBartolo in 1993 and Cadillac Fairview, the Canadian property developer, in 1995. Vultures, in financial jargon, are investors who scavenge bankrupt or distressed companies, buying up their loans or bonds. Investing in the distressed debt entails many of the same analyses as an LBO, figuring out the value of a company's assets and whether it generates enough cash to cover its debt. But when a company is going down the drain, it's much trickier to estimate how much value will be salvaged and how much value creditors will come away with. Under corporate law, creditors are ranked in a hierarchy that determines who gets what if the company becomes insolvent. At the top are banks, whose so-called senior loans are secured by the company's assets. They are followed by bondholders, suppliers, and employees. Shareholders stand at the back of the line, getting nothing unless the creditors are all paid off. When the company's assets are tallied up or sold off, creditors at the top of the ladder may be paid in full, while those at the bottom may get little or nothing. In between, some creditors may be only partly paid off. Those groups often get to swap their debt for an ownership stake when the business is restructured, which gives them a chance to recoup their losses. There are several ways to make money as a vulture, all risky. Some play the distress discount. For example, if a bond pays 10% interest on its face value and it's selling for 67 cents on the dollar because it might go into default, the buyer earns a 15% return on its investment. The effective interest rate is 50% higher than the normal rate because of the discounted price. That alone might attract some investors. If the bond doesn't default and pays off in full at maturity, they also stand to collect the full $1 in principal and score a 50% gain on their 67-cent investment. The investor may not have to wait until maturity to cash in if the company's fortunes improve, because the bond's market price will rise and the investor can sell out at a gain. Alternatively, you can gamble on layers of the company's debt that may not be paid off in full, but which are likely to be exchanged for equity when the business is restructured. This, however, is a game only for the bold, because the payoff hinges not only on the legal position of the debt, but on the performance of a troubled business and the volatile market for distressed debt. Restructurings and Chapter 11 reorganizations often spawn bitter disputes among creditors about who will be paid how much and who will get what when the company emerges from bankruptcy, battles that can drag out the rehabilitation of the company. No matter how many numbers you crunch through a spreadsheet, the payoff for any individual class of debt is hard to predict. When you look at distressed deals, you have to think very differently, says Blackstone partner Chin Chu. The negotiations are much more complicated, because you're playing three-dimensional chess with creditors, the equity holders, many tranches of creditors. With few LBO options on the horizon, though, Blackstone was ready to gamble. We're value investors, and we're pretty agnostic as to where we appear in the capital structure, Schwartzman says. In 2002, it became pretty clear that subordinated debt in a whole variety of companies was a terrific place to be. In other words, buying distressed bonds on the cheap was as good as buying equity if you could turn a profit that way. Blackstone tested its new strategy first on Adelphia Communications, the cable company that filed for bankruptcy in 2002 after admitting that it had fudged its books to conceal liabilities. Mark Gologly, whose team had been steeped in the cable industry since the mid-1990s, understood the business and was comfortable betting on Adelphia's debt. Art Newman, the head of Blackstone's restructuring advisors, was called in to help strategize. These guys knew the assets very well, and I understood the bankruptcy process, says Newman. In the secondary market, Blackstone bought up a sizable portion of Adelphia's debt and won a seat on the creditors' committee in the bankruptcy, where the firm pressed for a sale of the company. A few months later, in September 2002, Blackstone began buying up debt of Charter Communications, Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen's cable giant, which had mortgaged itself to the hilt to buy cable systems at outlandish prices, including Blackstone's T.W. Fanch, Bresnan, and Intermedia Holdings. In both cases, the underlying businesses were fundamentally sound. They simply carried too much debt, and that would be reduced in a restructuring. At that point, cable looked relatively well protected, says Schwartzman. Its systems were built out. Its systems were difficult to replicate. Customers liked watching television, and many of the new entrants that had tried to challenge cable had gone bankrupt. Blackstone splashed out a hefty $516 million from both the 1997 and communications funds for Adelphia and Charter debt. It was a massive bet, and for a while it looked like the investment had been badly mistimed. As Schwartzman looked on, the trading prices of the debt fell, recalls Larry Guffey, a young partner at the time who worked on the trades. We were underwater, painfully, particularly when Steve's calling you and asking you why it's underwater, which I remember very well. It still wasn't clear if the Adelphia and Charter wagers would pay off in mid-2003, when Blackstone began weighing a third big investment in distressed cable debt. This one would be equally risky, but also held the promise of redemption, for the companies in question were the two Callahan systems in Germany that Blackstone had written off just months earlier. Like Adelphia and Charter, the North Rhine-Westphalia and Baden-Württemberg cable businesses were basically healthy. They had simply run out of cash because they had spent too much too quickly to upgrade their networks and hadn't signed up enough new customers to keep pace. With new management and the costs under control, Blackstone saw a chance to atone for the earlier loss. Guffey, who had relocated to London in 2002, took over from Mark Gologly and Simon Lonergan, who had overseen the original German cable investments. The banks hadn't formally foreclosed, but the businesses were in such grim straits that, for all practical purposes, they belonged to the banks. Together with its co-investors from 2000, Quebec's Caisse de Dépôt and Bank of America, Blackstone approached one of the Baden-Württemberg's system banks and arranged to buy a big slice of the company's loans at a meager 19 euro cents on the euro, and then bought more in the open market at deep discounts. The investor trio had bought $20 million of debt of the sister company in North Rhine-Westphalia in the open market. The timing was as perfect as it had been disastrous in 2000 and 2001. The private equity firms swapped their debt in the Baden-Württemberg company for equity when the company was restructured, and Blackstone then bought out Caisse de Dépôt and Bank of America's stakes, giving it a controlling position. Working with a new CEO who had been brought in at the tail end of Callahan's involvement, they kept new capital spending in sync with revenues. "We slowed it down until the revenue caught up," Guffey says. The restructuring cut the company's debt to manageable levels, and the business was soon back on its feet. By 2005, profits were rising, and the company was able to borrow money to refinance its debt and pay a huge dividend to Blackstone and other shareholders. By the time Blackstone cashed out its last piece of the two companies in 2006, it had booked a profit of $381 million, three times what it had invested in the second round. That more than made up for the $264 million loss on the original investment. On top of that, the communications fund raked in a $312 million profit on the debt of another troubled German cable firm, Primacom, in which Blackstone had not previously invested. Blackstone also made back some of what it had lost earlier on Sirius, the satellite radio company, by buying its debt on the cheap. The communications fund raised in 2000, whose situation had looked so dire in 2002, had been patched up and was now posting profits. "We had just raised this $2 billion fund when the original Callahan deal foundered," Guffey says. "This was 15% of the fund, and it looked like it would be zero. We were down 8-1 in the seventh inning, and we turned the game around." Adelphia and Charter yielded big windfalls as well. Altogether, Blackstone more than doubled the roughly $800 million it gambled on the distressed debt strategy. The communication fund, for years, was the least profitable of all of Blackstone's funds, with an annual rate of return in the single digits. But thanks to the vulture plays and some later investments, by 2007, it had produced a respectable, if not spectacular, 17% annual return, better than Blackstone's 1997 fund. Slowly, it became possible, too, to make equity investments again, in many cases as a byproduct of the economic strains of the retrenchment. Across America and Europe, corporations had binged on acquisitions in the late 90s, and they were still gripped by indigestion. Many mergers had not panned out, and even those that had worked operationally had often left the buyers over-indebted. Many companies needed to sell assets to pay down debt and shore up their balance sheets, but there were few buyers. The markets had no appetite for IPOs, so they couldn't sell their subsidiaries that way. And the corporate world was generally reluctant to expand through acquisitions after the buying frenzy of the late 1990s. Flush with capital, Blackstone and other private equity firms were among the few buyers, and they began to fill the void. It took some ingenuity to find deals that could get off the ground, and the first round of new equity investments Blackstone made deviated from the standard LBO model in one way or another. When Blackstone took a minority stake in Nycomed, a Danish pharmaceutical company, as part of a consortium in October 2002, the buyers put up nearly 40% of the price in equity, far higher than the more typical 25% or 30%. They saw it as a growth play and calculated that the business would expand quickly enough that they could make LBO-level profits even without steep leverage. Likewise, the financing for the $4.6 billion buyout of TRW Automotive, a parts maker that autumn, was unorthodox. Northrop Grumman, a defense contractor, was acquiring TRW's parent company, another defense supplier, and needed to offload the auto subsidiary as quickly as it could to pay down the loans for the main takeover. Blackstone was unwilling to invest more than $500 million of its own, so Neil Simpkins, a young partner who was leading the deal, persuaded Northrop to keep a 45% stake while Blackstone tried to recruit other investors after the deal closed. In effect, the seller was offering installment financing for its own asset. Northrop even loaned Blackstone some of the money to buy its 55% stake. Still, it was hard to line up the debt needed to cover the balance. Ultimately, other investors joined Blackstone, allowing Northrop to sell down its stake to the 19% it wanted to retain. In another instance, Blackstone effectively provided financing for a public company to make an acquisition. There, PMI Group, a bond insurer, wanted to buy Financial Guarantee Insurance Company, a municipal bond insurer, from General Electric. But PMI's bond ratings were lower than FGIC's, and an outright purchase would have jeopardized FGIC's ratings. To insulate FGIC's credit rating from its new parents, Blackstone and Cypress Group, another private equity firm, stepped in and agreed to take 23% stakes each, so that FGIC was not deemed to be a subsidiary of PMI. The expectation was that PMI would one day be in a position to buy all of FGIC. Blackstone also made two bets on energy prices. In 2004, it took a flyer on a startup oil and gas exploration company, Kosmos Energy, that planned to drill for oil off the west coast of Africa, and it bought Foundation Coal, the U.S. subsidiary of RAW, a German company that was shedding assets. In late 2001 and 2002, when the markets were still staggering from the shock of the terrorist attacks, Blackstone managed to put out more than $1 billion of equity from its buyout funds and put a further $1.5 billion to work in 2003. Apart from the profits the investments earned Blackstone and its investors, those deals and others by private equity firms during that period injected much-needed capital into companies at a time when the capital markets were shut down. It was Blackstone's money, for example, that enabled Northrop and PMI to make key acquisitions. The firm helped fund the two startup insurance companies, as well as Kosmos Energy, another new company. In other cases, it bought assets that troubled companies badly needed to unload at a time when there were few other buyers. Its $1.7 billion deal with Bain Capital and Thomas H. Lee Partners to purchase the textbook publisher Houghton Mifflin in 2002, for instance, provided cash to the company's parent, the French media giant Vivendi, which was near collapse after an ill-considered campaign of takeovers. Another deal for Ondeo Nalco S.A., which made water treatment products, grew out of a restructuring of its French parent, the utility Suez S.A. It wasn't just Blackstone that was stepping up when buyers were scarce. Across Europe, the United States, and Canada, private equity firms paid considerable sums for the phone book subsidiaries of big telecoms that had to pare their debt in those years. In Germany, KKR scooped up a grab bag of industrial businesses, a plastic extruding equipment company, a crane maker, and others, that the huge German conglomerate Siemens had acquired just a few years earlier. The buyers were consummate opportunists, taking advantage of the disarray in the markets and the economic problems of the corporate world for their own and their investors' benefit. But the billions they invested at the bottom of the market supplied sellers with capital they needed to make it through the recession and helped set a floor under corporate valuations that had nosedived. With a wealth of capital at their disposal, private equity firms performed a role the mainstream capital markets had relinquished at the time. Chapter 16. Help Wanted. The upheaval in the markets wasn't the only challenge facing Schwartzman in the first years of the new millennium. He was also wrestling with a business that had long outgrown its management. No longer was Blackstone the small shop he and Peterson had managed on the fly for the first decade. Between 1996 and 2000, it had doubled to 350 people. In addition to its giant buyout fund, It now had one of the largest real estate investment operations on Wall Street, and it had just raised a new mezzanine fund which would make loans to mid-sized businesses. The real estate group was running swanky hotels.